You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 51 of our Civil War podcast. My name is Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all, thanks for tuning in to the podcast. A year after he went to war, a homesick soldier in the 24th Mississippi posed a rhetorical question to his fiancée. Why am I here? Was it merely that I might be an actor in scenes novel and exciting? That I turned my back on all the delights of home and subjected myself to the untold trials and privations of camp life and the fearful dangers of the battlefield? No, he answered. I am here because a numerous and powerful enemy has invaded our country and threatened our subjugation.
On the first anniversary of his enlistment, a soldier in the 36th Pennsylvania wrote of himself and his comrades, "When we enlisted in this war, we did no idle thing. We were in earnest. 1 year has passed away, and all the fancied romance of campaign life has proved itself to be a stern reality to us. But we are still in earnest, ready for another year of harder, bloodier work, if such is necessary to crush this wicked rebellion."
In this episode, we want to look at some of the powerful factors that motivated men to enlist in the Union and Confederate armies at the start of the Civil War. We're basically going to try to answer the question, why did Northern and Southern men sign up to fight?
In seeking to answer why Civil War soldiers were willing to sign up to fight and willing to give the last full measure of devotion in the war itself, we're fortunate to have a great wealth of evidence that provides us with a window into what the men in the armies really thought and felt.
That window into their thoughts and feelings comes from the personal letters written by Union and Confederate soldiers to family members, sweethearts, and friends, and also from the diaries that some of them kept during their wartime service. We have these rich veins of information to mine because Civil War armies were the most literate in history up to that time. It's estimated that more than 90% of white Union soldiers and more than 80% of Confederate soldiers were literate, and many of them regularly wrote letters to family and friends. And so scholars have been able to search through the vast amount of evidence in those letters and diaries and in the real thoughts and emotions of the soldiers, identify the convictions that caused thousands of men to volunteer and fight against each other in 1861.
In his book, For Cause and Comrades, Why Men Fought in the Civil War, James McPherson asks, quote, "Why did Civil War soldiers do it? It was not because their lives were somehow less precious to them than ours to us. Nor was it because they lived in a more violent culture that took fighting and dying for granted more than we do. And it was not because they were professional soldiers or coerced conscripts. Most Union and Confederate soldiers were neither long-term regulars nor draftees, but wartime volunteers from civilian life to which they longed to return. They did not fight for money. The pay was poor and unreliable. Most volunteers and their families made economic sacrifices when they enlisted. What prompted them to give up several of the best years of their lives, indeed, to give up life itself in this war?" End quote.
Back in the episodes about Fort Sumter, we said that scholars have long debated who was responsible, Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis. who was responsible for the event that proved to be the fateful tipping point that moved North and South from secession to war. But while the intentions and motives of the two sections' leaders are arguable, the results are beyond question. The first shots were fired, and there was no going back. The war had started.
In the North, the attack upon the flag stirred a tidal wave of patriotic wrath and a determination to avenge the act and punish its perpetrators. On April 15, 1861, the day after Sumter's fall, Abraham Lincoln issued a ringing proclamation calling for the states still in the Union to provide 75,000 of their militia to be used to suppress, quote, combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, end quote. The Southern response to Fort Sumter was similar in passion to the Northern reaction. It also came as a great outpouring of spirit and determination, but to resist coercion.
And y'all will recall that we said coercion in this context would be the use of armed force by the federal government to put down the rebellion, to force the seven already seceded states back into the Union.
Exactly. And with Lincoln's call for troops, the four still wavering slave states in the Upper South, that is Virginia, Tennessee, Arkansas, and North Carolina, they had to decide between participating in a war to coerce the already seceded states or else joining them. And as we know, those four states decided to cast their lot with the Confederacy. Their ties of blood and culture with the South proved stronger than their economic and political ties with the Union.
The Confederacy probably mobilized almost 1 million men between 1861 and 1865, an astonishing figure representing 90% of its available military-age white male population.
And it should be pointed out that only the presence of slavery, of course, let the Confederacy mobilize that many white men and still keep the Southern economy running.
Exactly. But as far as the Confederate mobilization, the initial impulse to volunteer came from a blaze of patriotic excitement that swept across the South, first with secession, and then it flared even brighter in response to the firing on Fort Sumter and Lincoln's call for troops. In North Carolina, a correspondent of the Times of London watched an excited crowd with, quote, flushed faces, wild eyes, screaming mouths, hurrahing for Jeff Davis and the Southern Confederacy, end quote. In Charlottesville, Virginia, an 18-year-old student at the University of Virginia wrote in his diary on April 17th, quote, no studying today. The news of Virginia's secession reached here about 10 o'clock amid huzzas and shouts. War, war, war was on placards all about. My company was called at 4:45. All was excitement and go, end quote.
Most of those Southern men who volunteered in the midst of that excitement professed patriotic motives for enlisting. Some scholars have portrayed the South during the Civil War as being a loosely knit collection of persons whose primary allegiance lay with their states. But actually, it seems that right throughout the war, a substantial portion of the Confederacy's white population identified strongly with their Southern Republic. A Georgian serving in Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia wrote to his wife saying, quote, when we consider the great duty we owe our country in the struggle for independence, I cannot but be content with my fate, although it be indeed a cruel one. I am determined to do anything and everything for my country. If it should be my misfortune to fall in the glorious struggle, I hope that I shall go, believing that I have contributed my share, and that you and my little boy will be entitled to the great boon of freedom. End quote.
Many Southern volunteers invoke the legacy of America's founding fathers. Confederate recruits believe they were the protectors of the heritage of Republican liberty sanctified by that heroic generation of 1776. One Southern volunteer wrote, quote, our cause is the sacred one of liberty, and God is on our side, end quote. And that same claim was repeated almost verbatim by many other recruits. A farmer who enlisted in the 26th Tennessee insisted that, quote, life, liberty, and property are at stake, and therefore any man in the South would rather die battling for civil and political liberty than submit to the base usurpations of a northern tyrant, end quote.
The legacy of the Revolution figured prominently in the explanations of Confederate volunteers as to why they'd signed up to fight. They believed that just as the American patriots of 1776 had seceded from tyrannical British Empire, so the Southern patriots of 1861 seceded from tyrannical Yankee persecution. A 20-year-old recruit from South Carolina pointed out that just as the founding fathers, quote, severed the bonds of oppression once, now we for the second time throw off the yoke and be freemen still, end quote. And a Texas cavalryman wrote that the American Revolution established, quote, liberty and freedom in this Western world, and we are now enlisted in the holy cause of liberty and independence again, end quote.
It's worth taking a moment here and acknowledging the presence of the elephant in the middle of the room. And that elephant in the middle of the room is slavery. It's all well and good that Southern volunteers invoked liberty as a goal they were fighting for, and we think they were sincere in those declarations. But we also think someone can believe in something sincerely and be completely wrong. As Abraham Lincoln put it, quote, the perfect liberty they sigh for is the liberty of making slaves of other people, end quote.
Most Southern whites insisted that one of the most cherished tenets of Republican liberty was the right of property, including slaves, human property. Despite the later attempt by the Lost Cause to make slavery a non-issue, the pairing of slavery and liberty as the twin goals for which Confederates fought appeared in many Southern volunteers' letters. A young Virginia schoolteacher who joined the cavalry and whose family owned slaves said, quote, better, far better to endure all the horrors of civil war than to see the dusky sons of Ham leading the fair daughters of the South to the altar, end quote. A slave-owning farmer enlisted in the 13th Georgia because, quote, our homes, our firesides, our land and Negroes, and even the virtue of our fair ones is at stake, end quote. A young Kentucky physician told his slaveholding relatives that he would join up because, quote, the vandals of the North are determined to destroy slavery. We must all fight, and I choose to fight for Southern rights and Southern liberty, end quote.
Those who wish to deny that the preservation of slavery was a goal for which Confederates fought have to somehow ignore the all-pervasive influence of slavery and racism in Southern society, economy, and politics. This all-pervasive influence goes a long way toward explaining why so many Southern whites who didn't own slaves fought for the Confederacy. And here we'll invoke the ghost of John Brown, because Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859 raised the specter of white Southerners' biggest fears, those fears being that, for whatever reason, there would be a massive and bloody slave revolt, or that Northern abolitionists would come South and force emancipation upon the South. And for some reason, Southerners believed that a significant part of the process of forced emancipation would be that Northern abolitionists would compel the fair women of the South to marry black men. After Lincoln's election, Baptist clergyman James Furman warned white Southerners that, quote, if you are tame enough to submit, abolition preachers will be at hand to consummate the marriage of your daughters to black husbands, end quote. So if you were a poor white farmer in the South, even if you didn't own slaves, if you had been told for years that the dastardly Yankees wanted nothing better than to come South and destroy slavery and force your daughter to marry a black man, and then if after years of that and after John Brown's craziness, if then war finally broke out and you were told the North was going to invade and subjugate the South, well, what would you do?
And we don't mean to beat a dead horse, since we've already talked about all this stuff before, but with the South's slave-based society that stressed white supremacy, even the poorest white person was somebody. That is, they had some standing in society simply because they were white. And even the poorest white could entertain the hope that someday he might pull himself a bit more up the social and economic ladder by becoming a slaveholder himself. So yes, the vast majority of whites in the South in 1861 didn't own slaves, but the Northern threat to slavery was a perceived menace to all whites in the South, slave owners and non-slave owners alike. Whites in the South, whether they be rich or poor, were conditioned to consider the bondage of blacks to be the basis of liberty for whites. And so our point is that many non-slaveholding whites had a racial, cultural, and even economic stake in the preservation of slavery, and we believe this goes a long way toward explaining why so many Southern men who didn't own slaves signed up to fight against the North.
We've talked before about the fact that over and over again, in the face of the perceived threat to slavery, Southerners over the years had said they would never submit to the North, that they would never put up with subjugation to the Yankees. And we said that those words, submit, subjugate, were like waving a red flag in front of white Southerners because they lived in a society in which only slaves submitted, only slaves were dominated. And so in the minds of Confederates, with the coming of war with the North, the pairing of slavery and liberty as the twin goals for which they fought was logical and natural. To their minds, the war was one of Northern aggression. The North wished to invade and subjugate the South, with all the attendant horrors to home and hearth that that conjured up. A slave-owning officer in the 20th South Carolina declared that, quote, "Sooner than submit to Northern slavery, I prefer death," end quote. The South's visceral commitment to the defense of land, home, and family against Yankee aggression can also be heard in the letter a private in the 56th Virginia wrote to his wife, in which he said, quote, "If we should suffer ourselves to be subjugated by the tyrannical government of the North, our property would all be confiscated and our people reduced to the most abject bondage and utter degradation," end quote.
So before we move on to cover the reasons Northern recruits fought for the Union, let's just summarize what we've said about the major motivations of Southern volunteers. And most importantly, we stressed the pairing of slavery and liberty as the twin goals for which Southerners fought. With complete sincerity, Southerners fought to protect their constitutional liberties against the perceived Northern threat to overthrow them. That arguably their most cherished liberty was the right to own human property means they were fighting to preserve slavery, to protect hearth and home from Yankee aggression that in their worst nightmares, white Southerners believed would lead to emancipation and all the attendant horrors and degradation that they were certain would go hand in hand with the freeing of 4 million previously subjugated black slaves.
And so in 1861, the War of Northern Aggression, as many Southerners saw it, represented a clear and present danger to their homes, families, and communities. Northern aggression represented a mortal threat to their liberty. A South Carolina politician warned that, quote, "If slaves are freed, whites will become menials. We will lose every right and every liberty which belongs to the name of freemen," end quote. So we think the bottom line is that Southern men fought for Southern rights and Southern liberty. And yes, that we had to add the word Southern before the words rights and liberty means we think they were fighting to preserve slavery. To us, there's simply no getting around the all-pervasive influence of slavery and race in Southern society, economy, and politics.
You know, for anyone who has listened through the entire podcast up to this point, hopefully it's come through that Tracy and I try to appreciate the individual stories of the people who were caught up in this whole amazing story. But it's probably also been evident that we have no sympathy for secession or the effort to establish a Southern slaveholding republic. And in that regard, what Grant wrote about Lee at Appomattox resonates very strongly with us. About that day in April 1865, Grant, in his memoirs, explained, "I felt anything rather than rejoicing at the downfall of a foe who had fought so long and valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause, though that cause was, I believe, one of the worst for which a people ever fought, and one for which there was the least excuse."
Thank you. I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
In the North, the initial impulse to volunteer also came from a blaze of patriotic excitement that swept across the region in response to the firing on Fort Sumter and Lincoln's call for troops. From Oberlin College on April 20th, a student wrote to his brother that, quote, "War and volunteers are only topics of conversation or thought. The lessons today have been mere form. I cannot sleep. I cannot work." End quote. In Ohio, a 21-year-old carpenter wrote in his diary on April 16th, quote, "The president's war proclamation has been issued, which causes no little excitement throughout the village. I went to work in the morning, but became so much excited by the war news that I wasn't able to resume my labors in the afternoon. Hearing that Spink and Shelby had opened a recruiting office, I put down my name." End quote. And in New York City, a young man who enlisted on April 15th said, quote, "The feeling runs mountain high, and thousands of men are offering their services where hundreds only are required." End quote.
At the start of the war in 1861, most of those northern men who volunteered in the midst of such excitement professed patriotic motives for enlisting. An Illinois man, in a letter to his fiancée, explained that, quote, "My heart burns with indignation against the armed rebels and traitors to their country and their country's flag. My hope has always been for a peaceful, quiet home of my own with you as a companion, but I have concluded to volunteer in the service of my country. This step will cause you pain and sorrow, I know. I love you still and always shall, but I can't stay behind." End quote. That soldier and his fiancée never married. He was killed in action in 1863.
A newspaper in Indianapolis captured the motivation of many northern recruits when it proclaimed, quote, "We must fight now, not because we want to subjugate the South, but because we must. The nation has been defied. The national government has been assailed. If either can be done with impunity, we are not a nation, and our government is a sham." End quote. Scholars who have examined thousands of letters and diaries written by Northern volunteers found them expressing similar feelings. "Fighting to maintain the best government on earth" was a common phrase used by many of them. A recruit from New Jersey wrote that the war was a, quote, "great struggle for the Union, Constitution, and law. Our glorious institutions are likely to be destroyed. We will be held responsible before God if we don't do our part in helping to transmit this boon of civil and religious liberty down to succeeding generations." End quote. and then a Midwestern volunteer, enlisted as, quote, a duty I owe to my country and to my children to do what I can to preserve this government, as I shudder to think what is ahead for them if this government should be overthrown, end quote.
Northern recruits also invoked the legacy of the Founding Fathers. A soldier from New England on the eve of First Manassas wrote to his wife, saying, quote, I know how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and sufferings of the Revolution. I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt, end quote. Many Northern volunteers believe that if disunion destroyed the nation, then the generation of 1861 would be proven unworthy of the heritage of Republican liberty sanctified by the blood and sacrifice of that heroic generation of 1776. A young lawyer leaving behind his wife and two small children to enlist told her, quote, Our fathers made this country. We, their children, are to save it. If our institutions prove a failure and our country be numbered among the things that were but are not, then of what value will be house, family, and friends? End quote.
Great numbers of Northern recruits referred in their letters and diaries to the Union. And there I made air quotes, even though you couldn't see them. But it's hard for us nowadays to believe that sensible young men would choose to fight for something as vague or as abstract as the Union. But in 1861, preservation of the Union was indeed the most powerful motivator for the vast majority of Northern volunteers, powerful enough that they were willing to fight and die for the Union. And to try to understand what Northern recruits meant by that term, and to understand the emotional impact of the threat secession posed to the Union, well, mentally translate it into the present-day idea of America, and what that means for the men and women serving in the military today. I mean, would the volunteers in today's military be willing to defend America if the very existence of the nation was being threatened? Well, of course, the answer is yes. And the same was true in 1861. The Northern volunteers who rushed to the colors back then were willing to fight and die to preserve the Union, to protect the concept of America that embraced the nation as a whole.
One of Abraham Lincoln's strengths as a wartime leader was his ability to translate the government's war aims into memorable prose. In his address to Congress in July 1861, he said, quote, Our popular government has often been called an experiment. Two points in it our people have already settled. The successful establishing and the successful administering of it. One still remains, its successful maintenance against a formidable internal threat attempting to overthrow it. This issue embraces more than the fate of these United States. It presents to the whole family of man the question whether a constitutional republic or a democracy can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its own domestic foes. End quote. Lincoln was basically saying that if the breakaway of the southern slave states was successful, then the world would see that America's experiment in democracy had failed.
In another speech, Lincoln insisted America was, quote, the last best hope of earth, end quote. Now, in that speech, the president was speaking of emancipation, but also speaking of the larger context of the United States as one nation, indivisible. But why was this so important? How was America the last best hope of earth? The last best hope for what? Well, keep in mind that in the mid-19th century, the United States stood almost alone in the world as a democratic republic. And like other political leaders of his generation, Lincoln was fully aware of the fate of most republics throughout history. They'd crashed and burned, right? And so in a world dominated by kings, emperors, a czar, and old world systems of aristocracy and inequality, the brave experiment launched in the new world in 1776 seemed fragile indeed. Many European leaders relished the idea that the Confederates' attempt to split the United States in two would be successful and would sweep the broken pieces of the upstart American experiment in government into the dustbin of history.
But when war came, Abraham Lincoln and thousands upon thousands of men in the northern states weren't willing to give up on the Union. Most Northerners in 1861 shared Lincoln's conviction that the fate of democratic government hung on the outcome of the Civil War. Many of the volunteers who enlisted in the Union armies were immigrants who had come to America from places in the Old World where democratic hopes had been shattered and crushed in recent memory. Such foreign-born Union soldiers understood exactly what Abraham Lincoln meant when he called America the last best hope of earth. And so the American sense of mission invoked by Lincoln, the idea that this new world experiment was a beacon of freedom for oppressed peoples everywhere, helped sustain Northerners through 4 years of bloody conflict between 1861 and 1865.
And before we move on, we just wanted to say that we know there are people out there today who talk and act as if they wish the Confederacy had won its independence during the Civil War, but we just don't understand that kind of thinking. We believe that not just the country we live in today, but the world we live in today would be a very different place if disunion had split the United States in two in the mid-19th century. And all you have to do is look at world history in the 20th century, and especially the two world wars fought in those years, to understand how things could have turned out very differently in so many ways. A Massachusetts private wrote to his wife in 1862, saying, quote, "I do feel that the liberty of the world is placed in our hands to defend. And if we are overcome, then farewell to freedom," end quote. And it's striking to think that those same words could have been written in 1918 or in 1944 by American citizen soldiers, men from the North and South and East and West, but Americans all, who went overseas to join our allies in a couple of world wars that were two of the defining events of the 20th century. But anyway, we're probably straying a bit off topic, so.
Anyway, the other thing we wanted to be sure to mention with regard to the motivations that impelled Northern volunteers to sign up to fight in 1861 is that relatively few of them mentioned the slavery issue when they enlisted. We've said it before, and it's worth repeating, but by today's standards, really by any standards, most white Northerners back in these days were just as racist in their beliefs and attitudes as white Southerners. But with 95% of America's black population living in the slave states, the South's measure of concern with racial control and white supremacy was so much greater than the North's that in the South, racism created a radically different set of values and priorities, like, for example, the desire to preserve and expand the institution of slavery.
But with the North, the racism that was also present there in that section of the country meant that ending slavery just wasn't one of the initial motivations that drove the vast majority of Northern men to sign up to fight. It wouldn't be until later in the war that most of the Union soldiers and Northern people came to see emancipation as a necessary war aim and an essential measure in suppressing the rebellion of the Southern states. And we'll, of course, have more to say about that change in attitude when we get to that time with the podcast.
But all of that isn't to say that no one who volunteered in 1861 saw the abolition of slavery as a driving motivation for enlistment. There were some who did, and they tended to be outspoken in their determination to destroy the South's peculiar institution and to cleanse the restored Union of an evil they considered to be a mockery of the American ideals of liberty. An Ohio artillery officer believed in June 1861 that the war, quote, "will not be ended until the subject of slavery is finally and forever settled. It has been a great curse to this country," end quote. And a captain in a Massachusetts regiment wrote to his mother in November 1861 that, quote, "slavery has brought death into our own households already in its wicked rebellion. There is but one way to win this war, and that is emancipation. I want to sing John Brown in the streets of Charleston and ram red-hot abolitionism down their unwilling throats at the point of the bayonet," end quote.
Well, despite the dramatic passion in that last quote, Before we move on, we just wanted to emphasize again that for many, or for most, Northern men who signed up to fight at the start of the Civil War, preservation of the Union was their major, overriding, principal motivation in volunteering. An officer in a New York regiment spelled out, simply and clearly, this idea when he said, quote, "If we lose in this war, the country is lost, and if we win, it is saved. There is no middle ground," end quote.
Besides those motivations for enlistment that we've already mentioned, for both Northern and Southern men, the Victorian masculine notions of duty and honor were also significant motivators. Broadly speaking, Union volunteers tended to speak more of duty, while Confederate soldiers were more apt to cite the obligations of honor. And just to make sure we're all on the same page, here are quick definitions of those concepts. To shirk duty is a violation of conscience. To suffer dishonor is to be disgraced by public shame. In his book, For Cause and Comrades, James McPherson points out that, quote, "Honor was primarily a masculine concept, not always appreciated by wives who sometimes felt that a man's duty to his family was more important than pride in his reputation. Several married Confederates, therefore, found it necessary to lecture their wives and daughters on the finer points of the male code of honor," end quote. Even though he was 39 years old and father of several children, a South Carolinian felt compelled to enlist. He explained to one of his daughters that, quote, "I would be disgraced if I stayed at home. The honor of our family is involved. A man who will not offer up his life does dishonor to his wife and children," end quote.
And then, as Tracy said, Union volunteers tended to speak more of duty. A school teacher who mustered into an Ohio regiment explained that, quote, "My country had a demand on me which made all my plans, calculations, hopes, and expectations of minor consequence," end quote. A lieutenant in a 3 months Pennsylvania regiment wrote in May 1861 that, quote, "I will not enlist for a longer period than 3 months, unless my country needs me, in which event I would enlist for life," end quote. And that's essentially what he did, fighting for 2 years until captured at Gettysburg and dying in Libby prison.
While many men on both sides volunteered to fight because of patriotism, to defend hearth and home, because of duty or honor, or simply for adventure, but bound up along with much of all that were the values and expectations of the men's local communities. Scholarship looking into the manner in which troops were raised and organized has found that the social forces at work in local communities exerted an extraordinary influence on Northern and Southern soldiers. As we mentioned previously on the podcast, the creation of companies and regiments on both sides was primarily a local matter. And so it's important to realize that back then, going to war was, in a very real sense, a collective experience for a local community, since it involved not just the men who became soldiers, but the entire community.
In 1861, at the start of the Civil War, hardly anyone among the public anticipated a long war. So such hopeful expectations meant men of military age had few excuses for remaining at home. And in this regard, I think it's interesting that women exerted a not insignificant social pressure on men to enlist. According to a young Louisiana volunteer, quote, "The ladies will hardly recognize a young man that won't go and fight for his country. They say they are going to wait until the soldiers return to get husbands," end quote.
Well, be that as it may, there was a strong link between local communities and the soldiers they sent to war. And again, this goes back to the way companies and regiments were raised back then. There was a genuine sense of community honor that the men of both sides took with them to war. And as we've said before, nowhere was the power of this link to their local community back home more evident than in the flags the soldiers carried to war. For Union and Confederate volunteers, abstract concepts like patriotism, defense of home and hearth, duty, or honor were powerful motivations, but they were, after all, well, mostly abstract concepts. But during the Civil War, the flags the men carried onto the battlefield became the very real symbols of those abstract concepts they were fighting for.
Again and again, on battlefield after battlefield, we see that Union and Confederate soldiers were willing to fight and die for their flags, because to them, those regimental and national flags were the tangible, concrete, visible symbols of the cause for which they had gone to war. The colors represented the soldiers' devotion to their community, their unit, and to cause and country. And so to keep the colors flying in the midst of battle was almost an all-consuming objective for the soldiers of both sides. The enemy concentrated its deadliest fire on those holding aloft the flags. Capturing a flag was an outstanding feat of bravery, often requiring acts of suicidal courage. Losing one's colors to the enemy was a shame only second to cowardice in action.
Despite the danger involved, there was no shortage of volunteers willing to undertake the hazardous duty of serving as color bearer or among the color guard. Soldiers took to heart a saying often repeated that the post of danger is the post of honor. Official battle reports are filled with citations of courageous conduct by a color bearer or members of the color guard. The soldiers of the color guard, usually 10 or 12 men, shielded the flag and often took it up one after another when bearers fell to enemy fire. One of the prouder moments for Iowans during the war came in February 1862 at Fort Donelson, Tennessee. The 2nd Iowa was in the front line of the Union assault, and every member of the color guard, save one, was killed. The survivor, a fellow by the name of Voltaire Twombly, bore the flag to the end and later received the Medal of Honor.
There were similar sacrifices on the Confederate side. At the Battle of Seven Pines, a South Carolina unit lost 10 of 11 color bearers. At the Battle of Antietam, the 1st Texas had 8 color bearers killed in quick succession. And at Gettysburg, the 26th North Carolina reportedly lost all 14 men who took up a single flag, one after another.
Flags during the Civil War were symbols, yes, but symbols powerful enough to evoke a willingness to fight and die for them. That was because the flags the men carried on the battlefield were the tangible, concrete, visible symbols of the causes for which the men had gone to war. James McPherson observed that, quote, "It is impossible to understand how the huge volunteer armies of the Civil War could have come into existence and sustained such heavy casualties over 4 years unless many of these volunteers really meant what they said about a willingness to die for the cause." End quote.
The ball kicked off because Abraham Lincoln was not willing to abandon the Union in order to keep the peace. And mirroring Lincoln's resolve, Jefferson Davis never considered that secession should be abandoned to prevent bloodshed. And so in April 1861, the war came. 4 years of bloody work lay ahead, but in 1861, few people on either side had expected such a determined will to fight in the other. But when war came, the soldiers we've quoted in this episode, and hundreds of thousands like them, followed a leadership which, on one side, would fight to preserve the Union, and on the other side, would fight for the right to leave it.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendations. And this time, we actually have not just one, but 3 book recommendations for y'all. The first should be no surprise. It's James McPherson's book, For Cause and Comrades, Why Men Fought in the Civil War.
And then the next 2 are books by Gary Gallagher. They are The Union War, in which he looks at what the Union meant to the generation that fought the Civil War. And then the other book is The Confederate War, in which he argues that we should not so much focus on why the Confederacy collapsed as we should look at how it lasted so long.
You can find all 3 of those books and all of our book recommendations at the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.blogspot.com.
Coming up next week, as promised, we will start in on First Manassas, or First Bull Run. And yes, we will address the name issue. But anyway, we're looking forward to using several, or more, episodes to look at what was the first major battle of the Civil War.
So for now, we'll say thanks for listening to this episode of the Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. We hope all of y'all will join us again next time, but until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.